Good morning and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for a half hour each weekday morning. This seems to be a very short period of time. It goes by very quickly, but we devote the entire half hour to your phone calls. That is, your phone calls and my response to your phone calls. If you call with questions about the Bible and the Christian faith or about your own Christian life, I'd be glad to talk to you about those questions you have. You can even call an opinion from the host and want to bring that up for discussion. That's fine also. The field of possible topics is very broad, and almost everybody out there hearing my voice has some kinds of questions or thoughts on some of these issues, and therefore you are welcome to be a part of the show. Not everyone will call, of course. Some people are a bit shy about that, but let me encourage you. We'll try to be very unintimidating here and make you feel comfortable calling, because we want you to be able to get your question on the table and give us a chance to discuss it, maybe bring some light to the subject that you're wondering about. The number to call is 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. One announcement before I begin to take these calls, and that is that this Saturday night at 6:30, we have a gathering in San Diego. I will be talking about the subject, The Three Views of Hell. Some of you have seen my book or have heard about my book on that subject, but you don't want to buy it, don't want to read it too long. Well, you can get a summary of the arguments for and against each of the three views of hell. If you don't know these views, it certainly does not hurt you to know them. It's not necessary for you to change your mind unless you have biblical reasons to do so, but it's good to know the different views that different Christians have. And so I'll be talking about the three views of hell this Saturday night, and it's at 6:30. The address and the map to the place is found at our website, thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com. You go to the announcements link and you'll find that information. That's for this Saturday, July 26th, 6:30 in the evening. Now, that's being held at the High Point Church in San Diego, and they have been kind enough to let us rent the place. This is not sponsored by that church. This is just a church kind enough to make their facilities available for us to have this gathering. All right, let's talk to Ryan, who's calling from Kansas City, Missouri. Ryan, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks, Steve. Always a privilege to talk to you. I wanted to ask you this morning about your view, always interested in your preterist interpretation of certain passages and things, related to the second coming of Christ. I know you do not believe in a literal thousand-year millennium that we're waiting to inaugurate, but you do believe Christ will come bodily and physically and literally in a future time. Do you believe that Jesus will come to a specific location, or is it just more of a general coming? Do you believe, for example, he's coming to Jerusalem and to Israel? And if so, how does that go along with the idea that, you know, Jesus is the new Israel and there is no more special reason for Jerusalem or Israel in any kind of way beyond what they already fulfilled in bringing forth Messiah? Do you believe he's coming to Jerusalem, and how does that jive with the preterist interpretation of Israel? That's my question.
Yeah, as I look at all of the passages about the second coming of Christ, which involves the resurrection of the dead, the rapture of the church, the burning up of the heavens and the earth, and the creation of the new heavens and new earth, all these passages about the second coming of Christ lack any reference to where he will come to as far as the earth, what part of the earth he'll come to. It is generally assumed by many that he will come to the Mount of Olives, which is just to the east of Jerusalem, and that many people think he'll set foot on the Mount of Olives and then he'll walk into Jerusalem. So this is, of course, the background for your question. I don't see anything in the Bible that says he'll set foot on the Mount of Olives. I do know, however, the scriptures that are used, there are two. One is in Acts chapter 1, where when Jesus ascended, two angels stood by and said to the disciples, "This same Jesus whom you've seen go up into heaven shall come again in like manner as you saw him go." Now, Jesus' ascension took place from the Mount of Olives. That's made plain in Acts. So he was on the Mount of Olives, and he ascended into heaven, And the angel said he will return in like manner. Some people think that the expression in like manner includes the implication of in the same location. Could be. I mean, there's certainly nothing to rule that out. He's got to come somewhere. So it could be that he'll come to the same location. But I would simply point out to anyone who's an honest Bible exegete that it doesn't say he'll return to the same place. He'll just come back in the same way. The same manner means in the same way. Jesus could come back in the same way and come to any point on the earth and still return in the way that he left.
Yeah,
so,
I agree.
There's no specific mention there of his location. Now, the other passage which people usually use to say Jesus will return to the Mount of Olives is in Zechariah chapter 14. Because there, in Zechariah 14, in verse 4, it says, "In that day his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which faces Jerusalem on the east. And the Mount of Olives shall be split in two from east to west, making a very large valley. Half of the mountain shall move toward the north and half of it toward the south. Then you shall flee through my mountain valley, for the mountain valley shall reach to Azal. Yes, you shall flee as you fled from the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah." Now, it says his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives and it'll split. But whose feet will stand there? There's no specific reference to Jesus or the Messiah in this passage. The person last mentioned whose feet would be presumably standing on the Mount of Olives is Yahweh. Now, of course, Christians believe that Jesus is Yahweh. But that's not saying that every time we find the word Yahweh, it's referring specifically to Jesus. Certainly in the Old Testament, we don't have a specific reference to Jesus as Yahweh. But when Yahweh is said to do something, it's usually not a reference to what Jesus is doing or will do. In this case, Yahweh, God, is standing on the Mount of Olives. Now, this does not necessarily refer to the second coming of Christ. In fact, I don't believe it does. And I don't believe it's referring to Jesus' feet on the Mount of Olives. I believe it's a reference to the same phenomenon that we read about in Ezekiel 11, where God stood on the Mount of Olives there too. You see, in Ezekiel 11, God was seen leaving the temple in Jerusalem and then leaving Jerusalem itself and moving east out the gate to the Mount of Olives. And then at the end of chapter 11 of Ezekiel, God is seen standing on the Mount of Olives, just like he is in Zechariah. Now, the standing on the Mount of Olives of God in Ezekiel is unambiguous in its meaning. The glory has departed from Jerusalem. God did dwell in the temple there, but he's left the temple. He's left Jerusalem. Jerusalem is no longer under his protection. He has moved outside the city, and he's now standing there and simply watching, not protecting the city, but allowing the Babylonian invaders to come and destroy it, something they would not be able to do if he remained in the city. But he has left the city. He's abandoned it. It's like when Jesus said when he walked out of the temple himself, "Your temple, your house, has left you desolate." And then he predicted that not one stone of it will be left standing on another. In other words, God has left the house here, the temple, and he's giving it over. He's not protecting it. He's left Jerusalem, and he's going to allow the Romans to come and destroy it. That's what Jesus predicted. Now, Ezekiel predicted that the Babylonians would come and destroy Jerusalem, and he emblemized it by God being seen leaving Jerusalem, abandoning Jerusalem, and standing outside Jerusalem on the Mount of Olives. That's what Zechariah also depicts. God is standing on the Mount of Olives. That means he's abandoned Jerusalem. Remember, Zechariah lived much later, after the Babylonians had destroyed Jerusalem and after Jerusalem had been rebuilt. Much later. So, as Ezekiel predicted Jerusalem would be destroyed by the Babylonians, well, after it was destroyed and rebuilt, Zechariah predicts it's going to be destroyed again. And it was in AD 70 by the Romans. So, I believe this is a prediction of a repeat of what happened in 586 B.C., God abandoning Jerusalem and leaving it to the Romans to destroy. Now, by the way, it talks about the mountain splitting and making a valley and people fleeing through the valley. If this is actually literal, and it was about the second coming of Christ, as so many people like to take it, where would people be fleeing to when Jesus has returned? He's touched the ground. If he's split a mountain open and there's a valley, what are people running to or from? You know, obviously, this is making an east-west valley, allowing the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the righteous, to flee from Jerusalem to the east. I believe this is symbolic for God having provided a way of escape for the remnant to escape from Jerusalem before the Romans came. Not a literal valley, certainly, but they did. We know that the Christian Jews fled from Jerusalem to the east. And I think
right.
that corresponds with what's being said here. The idea of a mountain literally splitting is not necessarily predicted here. Zechariah uses this kind of language a lot. For example, he talks about a mountain being removed in chapter 4. The mountain that's obstructing Zerubbabel from building the temple, mm-hmm. says this mountain will be removed and made a plain. The idea of there being changes in mountains melting like wax, mountains being removed, mountains splitting, these images are apocalyptic images that are not to be understood as literal. But the splitting of the Mount of Olives on the east and making a valley simply means those people of God who want to flee eastward from Jerusalem, which the Christians did in AD 70, that
yes.
God will make a way for them. He'll make a way for them. The obstruction of a mountain will be removed and a valley will be made for them. Not literally, but this is what
yes.
really did happen.
Yeah, that's well spoken, Steve. I do understand the dispensationalist argument, which I also disagree with. I guess I'm actually more just thinking of what, I guess you're basically saying you don't believe in the dispensationalist argument of the literal coming to Jerusalem, but what does the amillennialist believe he's coming? Is it just more, we'll just wait and see and find out? And then what do we do with
the thing? The difference between the amillennial view and a dispensational view is that the dispensational view believes that we've been given a lot of detail about all
yeah.
kinds of things about the second coming. The amillennial view is that we aren't given a lot of detail. We're told that Jesus
gotcha.
Is going to come back. He's going to raise the dead. He's going to rapture the church. He's going to renew the earth. That's what we're specifically told. We're not given information about what he'll be wearing, what color his eyes will be or his hair, or what geographical point he's going to first touch the earth at. So the amillennial view doesn't require, identifying the place where he'll land. The reason the dispensational view wants Jesus to land at the Mount of Olives is because they want him to restore the earthly Jerusalem. And they want him to come back to the Mount of Olives and go into Jerusalem. But the Bible doesn't describe him doing that. And so,
okay.
I mean, there are passages they use, but I'm saying that when you exegete those passages in their context, you can see the dispensationalist is reading into them things that aren't even remotely suggested in them.
No, I totally agree that they often do. Final, very quick point, Psalm 80 or 68 and Psalm 132, when it says things like, God has desired Jerusalem as his eternal home, his eternal dwelling place where he'll live forever, city of the great king. Do you feel like Jerusalem will have an eternal abode of Christ when he returns in any way?
I believe the Jerusalem where God abides forever is the heavenly Jerusalem, which
okay.
is the church. You know, the writer of Hebrews says that we have come to this heavenly Jerusalem. We have come to the city of God, to the innumerable company of angels and so forth, which he refers to as the general assembly and church of the firstborn, who are recorded
yeah.
in heaven. So the church is the spiritual Jerusalem. Paul said so too, and the writer of Hebrews said so. And so
Amen.
I believe that all eschatological references to Jerusalem are referring to the true Jerusalem, not the earthly type and shadow of it.
All right. Very helpful. Very good, Steve. Have a great day, brother. God bless.
Okay, Ryan. Good talking to you. Thanks for your call. Bye now. Okay, our next caller is Marie from Canyon Lake. Thank you for waiting, Marie. Thanks for calling. Welcome.
Thank you. My reason is, it could be a simple one. What reason might a minister have not to include the Lord's Prayer during the service? You know, the pastor.
Well, you mean
pray.
A minister who deliberately avoids it, or just doesn't always include it?
Never uses it. And when asked, he said, "Well, that's not the Lord's Prayer; that's the Apostles' Prayer." But in Luke 11, it makes it sound like it's everyone's prayer. All
yeah,
apostles.
Jesus taught it to be prayed. Well, I think the reason
I
that some
would
pastors
bring,
would.
I think it
Let me try to answer your question if I can, because we're going to run out of time here.
Go ahead.
I understand your question. You asked why would a pastor not include it, and there is a reason why some pastors might not. I don't know if this applies to your own pastor, but there are pastors who would say the Lord's Prayer is not for us during this dispensation. C.I. Schofield in the Schofield Reference Bible says the same. And essentially, the dispensational view is that the teaching of Jesus through most of his ministry was not for us, not for the church, but was for Israel, that Jesus was teaching that the kingdom was coming and that Israel was supposed to conform to these ways that he described in order to enter the kingdom. But the dispensationalist believes that the Israelites rejected the kingdom, and therefore the kingdom did not come. It was postponed until the millennium. And therefore, they say the teaching of Jesus during his lifetime is not for us during this church dispensation. It's the kingdom teaching. And certainly they say that the Sermon on the Mount is the teaching for the kingdom of God, and they believe that's been postponed till the millennium. So we live, they say, in a different dispensation, and things like the Lord's Prayer are not really for us in this dispensation. Now, I disagree 100% with that statement. And I believe the Lord's Prayer is what the church is to pray. And the reason that the church throughout history has included it in their liturgy is because they weren't dispensationalists, because they actually did believe that Jesus' teachings are relevant to us. After all, Jesus told the disciples, go into all the world and make disciples, teaching
yes.
them to observe everything I've commanded you.
Yes.
Okay, so everything Jesus commanded is what we're supposed to be teaching the nations. So the dispensationalists are certainly wrong about that, and it's a shame because they deprive the church of Christ's teachings for them. And many dispensationalists actually say the only teachings in the Bible that are for us are Paul's letters.
Oh.
They say that Peter's letters and John's letters and James' letters are there for the Jews, and Jesus' teaching, that's for the Jews, that's not for us. This is some of the damage I think that dispensationalism is capable of doing, is depriving the church of most of the things that Jesus said to us.
Well, I think
so. I don't know if your pastor is also a dispensationalist. Yeah.
I miss it because I have had it in the past, and I feel it's something that brings a whole congregation together, where a minister will pray by himself. But when they ask for the Lord's Prayer, then you've got the whole congregation, and it just feels like it's a coming together to me.
Yeah,
and
I'm
that
with
was
you.
Why my question.
I'm with you. Now I don't know if the reason your pastor does that is because of dispensational leanings, but there are definitely pastors who would not include it because they consider it's for a different dispensation, not us. Now, I believe that it's a very good thing for churches to pray the Lord's Prayer, like you said, for the reasons you say. I also think it's not a great sin if, you know, a service or two goes by and it's not included, but I do think Jesus said, when you pray like this.
Pray like this.
And
yes.
I think that we should do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Amen. Well, thank you, Marie, for your call. I appreciate your question. I hope that helps you. Theo from St. Petersburg, Florida. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Steve.
Hi, Theo. Thanks.
I was listening to an older program of yours, and you were having a conversation with a caller, and a couple of times you reiterated the following that because I guess there was a question concerning Calvinism or Arminianism, and I think you concluded by saying you can't imagine what difference it would have on you, and I guess practically speaking, as a Christian, which view you held to. And I don't know if I needed you to clarify that, because I thought of them right away
Tell me what difference it would make for you, because the way I see it is following Jesus is easily defined by simply reading, for example, what Jesus taught. Now, Calvinism and Arminianism are different opinions about what took place behind the scenes in the secret councils of God that lead me to become a disciple or not. You know, the Calvinist says, well, you were predestined from the foundation of the world to be a disciple, and that's why you are one. The Arminian says, no, not necessarily. You had free choice in the matter, and that's why you're a Christian. But either way, both agree that Christianity is following Jesus. So if I was a Calvinist, I would believe in following Jesus. If I'm an Arminian, I believe in following Jesus. I might have
right,
a different opinion than another man does about what secretly was done behind the scenes, but how does that have any practical value to me?
Right, but if I was convinced of, let's say, Calvinism, to me it seems more deterministic, more fatalistic. And if I was considering whether I should give in to a sin or not, I would say, well, if it was God's will for me to resist this, then I would not give in. So why even put up the effort? You know, I'm
saying. I understand.
I
understand. But see, that doing so would be allowing your moral behavior to be dictated by your theology, instead of by the commands of Christ. See, if my theology is I'm either going to sin or not because I'm predestined to do so or not, well, so I might as well just do it. No, that's the wrong answer. I mean, even if I believed that I am predestined either to sin or not to sin, I still have a command not to do it. So I would have to avoid and resist temptation. Whether I, and if I fell and I was a Calvinist, I might say, well, I guess God, you know, that was predestined that I would fail in this case, but I'm supposed to keep trying. And, you know, I realize what you're saying, that if I don't keep trying, then I was predestined not to. If I just become a total lazy person and don't serve God, that's because I was predestined not to. Everything was predestined. I understand that. I understand that a person's philosophical or theological commitments could evaporate their motivations, you know. But at the same time, we live our lives as Christians not by what our theological presuppositions about those things are, but by the fact that Jesus is our Lord and we obey him. And therefore, if I was a Calvinist, I would still believe my obligation is to obey Jesus, and that's what I would endeavor to do. If in the back of my mind I thought, yeah, you know, if I fail in this, God predestined it, well, then that would make me think God's not very nice to tell me to do something and then to force me to do something else. But at the same time, it wouldn't change the way I see myself as obligated to live. And by the way, there's lots of Calvinists who live very godly, holy lives. And
right.
I say, well, why would they bother to do that?
You know? Who I felt was consistent with their theology. But but yeah, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah. A lot of people live better than their theology.
Yes. Yeah. All right. Well, that was my only question.
Okay. And ultimately, we'll be judged by what we do, not what we imagine to be the case behind the scenes.
Okay. Very good, Steve.
Okay, Theo. Thanks for your call. Good talking to you. All right. Betty from South Pasadena, California. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, Steve.
Good morning.
Good morning. Yesterday, there was a gentleman that called in about the prayer over the food report, and that we're eating things that God, in the Bible. I would like to know, where in the Bible does it say that we should not eat the split hoof animal or animals that chew the cud?
Where does it say we should not eat certain animals?
Yes, and fish. It's
found in Leviticus chapter, what is it, 15? It's somewhere. That's a different uncleanness thing. Let me see. It is in Leviticus and also in Deuteronomy. There are lists of animals that are clean and animals are not. I think it's Leviticus maybe 11. I'm just kind of glancing through my Bible right now, looking at the. I don't have. Okay, it's chapter 11. In Leviticus 11, there's this long list of foods or animals that the Jews were forbidden to eat. You'll also find commands about such things in Deuteronomy, in various places. I think Deuteronomy 14, perhaps, and. And that's where it says, actually, the kind of animals that were not to be eaten, if we're talking about mammals, because it also talks about birds and such things, and fish. But when it talks about mammals, it says the only animals that were really clean or kosher were those who had two traits. They had to have both traits, or else they were unclean. One was that they had to have a split hoof, like a cow or a sheep or a goat does, or a deer. They have split hooves. And they had to chew the cud, which means they had to be ruminants. Only a minority of animals are ruminants. And they had to have a split hoof and be ruminants. Now, a pig has a split hoof, but it's not a ruminant. So it was unclean. It didn't have both those traits. It had only one. Camel is, I think, a ruminant, but it doesn't have a split hoof. So it was unclean also. It had to have both those traits. So cows, sheep, goats, deer, gazelle, and some other animals like that were clean foods. They could be eaten because they had both of those qualities.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Sure. And, of course, what we were talking about with that caller the other day was that those laws of clean and unclean foods, they were ceremonial laws. Now, some people point out that there could be a hygienic or health concern behind some of the selection of things that were edible and not. Obviously, pork can be contaminated with parasites that can hurt you if you eat it, and shellfish also, and things like that. And so some people have said, well, God chose these animals to be clean or unclean based on the health considerations, whether it's safe to eat them or not. Well, I think any health considerations with reference to clean and unclean foods would be a secondary consideration. I believe that the animals that were chosen to be clean or unclean were chosen on a basis of symbolism. Ritual laws have to do with symbolism, and they symbolize spiritual things. Unclean animals, for example, were symbolic of Gentiles or unclean people. We know that because when Peter was on the rooftop in Joppa, God gave him a vision symbolically. A sheet was lowered down full of animals. Many of them are unclean animals. And Jesus told Peter, eat these animals. He said, I don't eat unclean things. And Jesus said, what I have cleansed, don't you call common. And clearly, we know in the context what Jesus was trying to get across to Peter is that Peter considered the Gentiles to be unclean, like these unclean animals. But Jesus was saying, you need to not call them unclean anymore. You need to go to this house of Cornelius and preach to him, even though he's a Gentile. So I believe the symbolism of unclean animals was representative of unclean people. That's why they couldn't plow with an ox and an ass together. An ass is an unclean animal. An ox is a clean animal. And Paul applied that to don't be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. You're clean and they're unclean. You don't yoke them together. That's a law of Deuteronomy about animals that were clean and unclean. Paul applies it to people. So I think that that's what the symbolism was, and we're not under that symbolism anymore. We're not under those dietary laws. You've been listening to The Narrow Path, and we are listener-supported. If you'd like to help us pay the radio expenses, you can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, good morning. This has been today's The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Your chance to ask Steve a question about something you've encountered in your own spiritual journey, or something about the Christian life you don't understand, or something in the Bible. This is such a valuable service to the body of Christ, and we're so grateful to Steve for having us, you know, make sure that he's on the air here. But that's where you and I come in. We want to make sure that Steve can stay on the air, that these questions continue to get answered, and that there's some place for people to turn to when they don't understand something. It is a way for you to be able to give back when you listen and give. And if you are able to do that, please go ahead and go to Steve's website, thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com, and you'll find a place right there where you can give safely and securely, as well as alongside of a lot of very wonderful and free resources. But the place to give is clearly marked. However, if you would like just an address, or you'd like to give a donation in another way, you don't want to do it online, then you can call us here at K-Bright, and we'll give you additional information to reach Steve. Call us at 800-227-2337. Up next, it's time now for Joyce Meyer with her series on living a blessed life. In the meantime, though, please remember that the views and opinions on this program are those of the participants, and not necessarily those of Crawford Broadcasting Company, its ownership, management, or its advertisers. This is AM 740 K-Bright.
One-third of teens on the street will be lured toward prostitution within 48 hours of leaving home. Human trafficking is happening here, and Christians need to fight it. Learn more as we dedicate July to Human Trafficking Awareness on The Bottom Line, weekdays from 3 to 5.
At 50,000 watts, this is Southern California's most powerful Christian station, KBRT and KBRT HD Costa Mesa, and on the web at KBRT740.com.
Welcome to Enjoying Everyday Life with New York Times bestselling author Joyce Meyer. On today's program, Joyce will be teaching from her series entitled Living a Blessed Life. When you hear people talk about a blessed life, what does that mean? You might think a blessed life is having a lot of possessions and success, or maybe it's a worry-free life with a happy family. In reality, there's much more to a blessed life than just those things.
Jesus said that he came to bring life, and life more abundantly. But his life goes beyond just the physical. He blesses the very being of who you are as a person. And in turn, you are able to bless the world around you. Stay tuned and find out what the key principles are to having this kind of blessed life. Now here's Joyce with today's teaching, Living a Blessed Life.
Most anybody listening to me today, if you want to know the root cause of your unhappiness, it's selfishness. Just selfishness. And I prayed this real spiritual sounding thing about a month ago. Oh God, I want you to deliver me from all selfishness. And to be honest, when I prayed that, I probably didn't think there's going to be too much to deal with. I don't know what I thought, but I know now that if I would have known what I was getting ready to see, I would have kept my mouth shut. Because I'm telling you what, in the last 3 or 4 weeks, it's been like... There it is again. 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 So I think if I see the things that are still issues for me, I would really...